Like many of you, I just finished watching a three-part reality television series, otherwise known as the presidential debates. Unlike anything I've ever witnessed in my very long life. And of course, a lot can be said. There's a lot to be discussed in terms of the political realm about what we're looking forward to. But what needs to be talked about is what does Christian witness look like in the midst of a culture that's seemingly turning its back on God? Now, I say that as a strategic question in that there has always been the fact that Christians have lived their lives in corrupt cultures. You can't point to me a decade and say that was just not one in which sin existed. Can't do it. And truthfully, the way in which our culture is being seen is heightened by the fact that we have instantaneous knowledge through social media, the news. We go back to biblical times, there wasn't Twitter wars going on. It took about 7, 10, 15 days to hear some event in some city far away. And so in the midst of what we are watching unfold, we can say pretty clearly that Christian integrity, Christian speech, Christian ethics are really not on the top part of the list of politicians this go around. I would argue it's been that way for a little while. The bigger question is not who wins. The bigger question, though, is who are we in the midst of the culture? How do we live our lives in the midst of sin? How do we live our lives as sinners in the midst of sin? How is it that we, in fact, engage in the mission that Christ has called us to, like our window says, go therefore and make disciples of all nations? How do we do that when it's frustrating the ways in which the Christian witness is being denigrated? When we get to the end, you're going to see that we're actually becoming more and more like the first century church, which is in many ways frightening for folks, but it's actually a very exciting thing. We'll actually be unhindered in many of our allegiances to actually just be faithful Christians, regardless of what anybody else says. And so that's where we're heading. What does it look like to be Christians today? Now, of course, the one aspect of this is what we're looking at is prayer. How do we live our lives prayerfully in the midst of the place where we're called to live? Well, in this text, we have, again, Moses or Abraham's conversation with the three men, one of which is the Lord. And in this passage, he talks about the call given to Moses. Here's what he has been called to. He's called to direct his family on the way of the Lord, to do what is right and do what is just, in order that the promise will be fulfilled. That is to say, that in and through him, the promise of God to his people would proceed for generations and generations ahead. And of course, that would be coming through the son to come, which is Isaac. Notice that the language there is just much like what we just did a few minutes ago in charging parents to raise their own kids, right? You have exactly this call upon by God upon people to do this very thing, to devote their lives to the Lord, his ways, not the culture's way, and to do what is right and just along the way. That is to say, you do those things that are true, as well as those things that have an effect on the righteousness of the people, a justice involved, not letting the lies outweigh the truth. Righteousness and justice. The call given to Abraham. So obviously I've written it wrongfully there, Abraham. This is the call upon Abraham's life. And it's a call that is upon his life no matter what happens. And yet the Lord explains to Abraham, Abraham must be in hearing distance of the conversation, and saying that he's investigating the outcry of what's unfolding in Sodom and Gomorrah. That's to say, he's heard. We don't know what the outcry is, but it's coming from people in the city or if it's coming from cities surrounding the city, saying that really the state of affairs in this particular civilization is worse. It's awful. It requires the Lord's intervention. What does that kind of what's unfolding in the midst of Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, we'll read in the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 16, verses 49 to 50. It just spells it out. Now, this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant and overfed and unconcerned, and they did not help the poor and the needy, and they were haughty. They did detestable things before me. The book of Jude attaches this to sexual immorality, which you read the passage, it's really quite a scary affair of sexual sin. And therefore, I did away with them as you have seen. That's how the story actually unfolds. Abraham's bidding for the city actually unfolds because there wasn't found. Just Lot and his family were allowed to leave. It's a long list. It's a culture in so many different ways that has simply turned their backs on God. They were arrogant. They were the first priority in their own lives. They had plenty to eat. It wasn't like a culture in crisis. Wealth is what is indicated in this. Arrogant and wealthy. Unconcerned. Didn't care about the needs of others at all. You can imagine how surrounding cities would have felt, which would be the nature of the outcry, because you have this arrogance, you have this selfish wealth unfolding. They didn't help those who were in need. Then, of course, they engaged in a variety of acts. You can imagine murder unfolding from this. You can imagine, of course, the sexual sin unfolding from this. You can imagine the stealing unfolding from this. It's a society in complete and utter chaos. Corrupt through and through. And notice that this behavior is exactly the opposite of that which the Lord had called Abraham to. And yet, Abraham intercedes on their behalf in the midst of a prayer. A prayer that the Lord wouldn't do what he's about to do in order that the righteous would be preserved in the city. Why would you pray for the righteous to be preserved in the city? So that the righteous would be the means by which the city would become hear of the good news of the Lord, as well as be protected in its midst. Well, don't do the unlawful thing of taking out the righteous along with the wicked. And Genesis commentator says this is absolutely remarkable for two reasons, because if you look a few passages prior to this, Abraham had gone and rescued the king of Sodom. He knew the guy. From the eastern kings, he restored all of his property. He was kind of a knight in shining armor on behalf of this king, and yet he was treated by the king and the people with ingratitude. I don't know, you go save someone's life, save a city in this sense, and you're treated disrespectfully. Do you go to bat for them after that? For being honest, in our own human circumstances, look in your lives, you've gone to bat for someone, and they've turned on you even though you provided for them in amazing ways. Are you inclined to go and speak on their behalf? That is not the nature that we have. The nature that we have is to be angry about that. And interestingly, secondly, other prophets in the Old Testament, they made intercession all the time, particularly for the people of Israel who had turned their back on the Lord. Time and time again, the king turned the people away from the law of the Lord. You read this through 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Chronicles. They did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the intercession from prophets is, Lord, don't turn your back on your people. But Abraham prays for Canaanites. He's not praying for his people. He's praying on behalf of foreigners whose society has raised a stench to the Lord. It's a remarkable thing. Absolutely remarkable thing that he does. Why this is so important to point out is because as we get the telegraphing moment for us who live on this side of the resurrection, we see that this is precisely the kind of behavior that unfolds from Jesus Christ. That he himself was one in which an outcry to the Lord was given on behalf of all sinners. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. The outcry was so great that he did just like the Lord did in Abraham. He came down to see what the mess was about. And yet, the question could be asked, was there 50? No. Was there 45? No. Was there 40 righteous there? No. At the end of the day, there's only one. And it was Jesus Christ himself who put himself in the place of the punishment that befell Sodom and Gomorrah in the midst of their own sins. He now took upon himself. And it's echoed by the act of Abraham, interceding with the Lord on behalf of the Canaanites. And you look at the cross and you see Jesus Christ doing, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. What else can we say about the Sodom and Gomorrahs of the world? Is that, Father, forgive them. They don't know the damage they're doing. They don't know the way they are destroying themselves inside and out, both in the midst of their own families and their relationships, as well as to the damage they do to this society at large. They just don't get it. And Jesus prayed for them, and we are to do the same things as well. And therefore, we see in this text kind of the echo of what will be for Jesus the evangelistic imperative. It's an important word that we speak the gospel, the evangelistic gospel, that people would know and to love Jesus Christ. And Jesus is not interested in a witness from Christians that is constantly denigrating its enemies. Pray for your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, he says. It's a great text in which the disciples and Jesus go into a village, a Samaritan village, which people, again, who are their enemies, and they were brushed off. And James and John comes to Jesus and says, Lord, I love the guts of this. Do you feel like this? Lord, should we call down fire from heaven on them? Let's just wipe them out. Bam. To which Jesus, the text says he rebuked them. He actually said, shut up. We don't talk that way. This isn't what it's about. For the Lord is interested in shining his light, a witness, into the culture in order to shine the light of God in the midst of darkness. That is to say, he's training his disciples to go into a first century world, by the way, run by Romans, who had wealth, they were overfed, they were violent, sexual immorality was ripe. They were not the people who were following the way of the Lord, but they ran the known world at the time. And Jesus took 12 guys, put them in a room, started training them to go out into the midst of that society and to transform it. And we are here in Escalon in 2016, worshiping the Lord here freely in our society due to the fact that they were successful and the Roman Empire no longer exists. Amazing, isn't it? Little Middle Eastern startup religion attached to the Jewish faith that believes so strongly that Jesus was the Messiah that they changed the world. This is what Jesus is calling us to. Christians witness in a culture that is turning its back on the Lord. And it requires us to live differently. It requires us to do the very opposite things that Sodom and Gomorrah was devoted to. It requires us to do what is right and just, following the ways of the Lord. When I think about some examples to close with, about the evangelistic imperative of those shining the light of Christ in dark places, a couple that I wanted to highlight. I grew up in college. I watched a guy named Danny Werfel, who was a quarterback for the Florida Gators at the time. And as I watched his story unfold, he's a freshman, started. He took him to 4 SEC championships, won national championship, and he was a Christian. His dad was a military chaplain. And he was, at the time, I mean, it was Tebow before Tim Tebow was Tim Tebow, 1996 era, 7, 8, and 9. And he was just a remarkable witness. And as he went into the pros, he had kind of a pedestrian pro career, just didn't really take off. But he was quarterback for the New Orleans Saints. And while he was quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, he got involved in a mission called Desire Street Ministries. It was a ministry house set up in one of the poorest places in New Orleans to help kids off the streets, those in the midst of violence and drugs. You can imagine. I mean, these are boys and girls going through some of the toughest times of their lives. And as Pro Career continued to kind of flounder, he tried to stay in shape in order to get another position. And he said, I found himself driving down the street in New Orleans, and he had a choice. He'd be choosing to go left to the gym or to go right to Desire Street Ministries. And more and more and more, he kept not taking the left and taking the right to go help out these kids. And this is part of the ministry. And of course, as you know, when Hurricane Katrina hit, it completely destroyed and devastated this ministry of Desire Street Ministries. Danny Werfel has been involved in the rebuilding process of that. They've expanded their reach, continuing to outreach to kids in their community who don't get a good education, who are in the midst of drugs and violence, and again, the difficult home lives that kids on the street experience. It's been an exciting ministry that has unfolded in a place that people wanted to label as the lost place of New Orleans. Again, Lord, for the sake of one righteous, 10 righteous, 20 righteous, will you not destroy the city? He's been remarkable in his witness. Those who have gone to some of the darkest places and have shined the light of Christ there. Tim Keller planted a church in Manhattan in the late 80s. It was said, and you could not plant a church in Manhattan unless it was kind of theology light. Just kind of go there and you believe in Jesus, but just don't really commit yourself to much because people aren't interested in religion in the city. And he said, Baloney, he planted a Presbyterian church in Manhattan. Has now grown to some 6,000-7,000 people on a Sunday. And it's a church that is filled with young urban professionals in the ages of 20 and 30. That is their largest demographic. It's unbelievable. These are the people you didn't think you could reach. And doing so with heavy theological messages in which people are encouraged by his preaching to go out and to engage with the atheist who sits in the cubicle across from you. To engage with the person who is completely devoid of any understanding of the scriptures at all. And to do so winsomely and effectively with an apologetic approach that is remarkable. And the outreach they've planted in terms of the number of church plants in that area is just continuing to grow in remarkable ways. Why is this unfolding? Because they are doing that very same thing. They are these people who come into the city and they start their mission on their knees, praying for the people who seem to be unreachable, who we'd like to dismiss, who we'd like to say, Lord, they've been given enough chances, just drop the fire on them. And they don't. Which is why the evangelistic imperative always begins with a heart for, as well as a prayer for those who are lost. Pray on behalf of those whose sins have caused an outcry to God. One of the great passages in the evangelistic outreach, particularly in Redeemer, Presbyterian, but as well as churches throughout the world, is the one from Jeremiah 29:7. It's given to a people who are in Babylon. It's given to a people who once had the beauty of Jerusalem, who now are in exile in a foreign land with a foreign ruler, longing for their homeland. It says, seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. You're going to read a lot about this in the years to come, that we're going to begin to experience much like what Europe has experienced. Whereas Christians in society, we will feel like we are more and more in exile. We are not really at home. It's actually a good thing. Sometimes when we get too comfortable, we tend to neglect the evangelistic imperative of proclaiming the good news to the people. But notice what Jeremiah is saying here. When you're planted even in a foreign place that doesn't share your values, that is far from God, you still are called in your lives to seek its welfare. That is to say, you are going to go public with your faith in order to seek its good because for in its welfare you find yours. What would that look like for us to begin to do that very same thing in terms of our evangelistic imperative, to seek the welfare of the places where we are planted? We're not going to change the trajectory of a political Twitter war, but we can change the trajectory of the place where we live by those who are praying for the lost, by those who are praying for one another, in order that we seek the welfare of the places where God has put us. Regardless of if it feels like exile or home, we seek its welfare because we are called to be this interceding presence, this light in darkness, this salt in a saltless society. This is what Christians do. And therefore, like Abraham, who priestly interceded on behalf of these folks, and Jesus, who was our high priest, who took our place and our own corruption, we are called to pray for those in need as well. Let us seek him as we do that this morning. Let's pray.